Everything has a beginning. Every person, every idea, every journey starts somewhere. It's one small step in a new direction, a catalyst that ignites a spark. It's a moment when, from this point forward, nothing will ever be the same. It's not always comfortable. It's not always easy, but we need to start somewhere. We all need a starting point.
Well, hey, Crosspoint, so good to see you today. My name's Kurt, if we haven't had a chance to meet. How about this band? Were they not just amazing? You notice I say the band, not just Brad and the band, but the band. You got something else coming your way. We're in week four of the series called Starting Point, which I am loving. You guys enjoying the series? Because, man, I tell you what, I've been learning new things every single week. And really the premise of this series is, what if we just realize that faith has a starting point? Because so many times we know everything else has a starting point, but we don't always connect the dots that faith has a starting point. And so in this series, we've just asked the question, what if we were to kind of hit the reset button? What if we were to start over and kind of wipe the slate clean? And I know it's not quite that easy to do because, you know, we have roots and we have emotional ties and we have religious backgrounds and systems we've kind of put into our life, all kinds of things. But for the most part, what if we could just kind of, you know, ask some foundational and formational questions again? And so that's what we've been doing. And so in Word in week four of the series, and if you missed the first 3 weeks, you can go to crosspointweb.org and you can go to the watch button. And under the watch button, you'll find all the previous weekends. And you can kind of catch up. Or if you have, you know, a friend that you're like, man, I wish they could see this. Or, you know, I don't know that I can say it the way that I heard it. And so I'd like to show this to my parents. Or maybe you just want to watch again. As long as the internet's up, it will be there. So go to the watch button and you can find each of the previous weeks there. Now, today, I want to talk about, specifically in the context of religion and faith, the role of rules, right? And let's be honest, this is the part we don't like, right? The rules, because in every religion, there's these pesky rules. And here's the thing, in every religion, somebody gets to make up the rules, and guess what? It's not you, and it's not me. And so, but it's reality. In every single, you know, religion, we run up against the rules. And so, like in Islam, you have the five pillars of faith. And, you know, you have in the Old Testament, you know, or in the, you know, Judaism, you have the Ten Commandments. You have Jesus's, you know, Sermon on the Mount. You know, if you're following Sikhism, then there's a whole list of rules. If you're a Buddhist, then there's these principles that you have to follow. So everybody's kind of got their rules, and we don't make them up. And so we kind of just continue to bump into them, and we don't like them, but they're there. And so, you know, some of you know that I grew up in a Christian home, and I grew up in the Christian faith, and, you know, of course, I'm a pastor of a Christian church. So I can kind of poke fun at the Christian lineage a bit because I'm a part of it. It's been a part of my story. I'm not going to do that with the other faith traditions. I'm not a part of those. But Christianity is really kind of weird, I mean, if we're honest, because you have all these different versions, right? Like you had Church Universal to begin, Catholicism. This is where all Jesus followers started, with Church Universal, and from that came the Protestant faith. And then, you know, after the Protestant faith kind of came on the scene, you have like millions of brands and different, you know, applications of the Protestant faith. So to better understand this, I thought it'd be fun to do a little segment called Church History Through the Ages. All right, you guys ready for some fun? All right, so here's what we're going to do. I'm gonna try to explain and list as many different brands of Protestant faith as possible over the next 3 minutes and give some explanation to them. And the band, you guys are going to be a part of this, that's why they're still up here. The band, you guys are going to, like, capture the genre of that particular, like, season of faith, all right? You think you can do this?
Hopefully,
all right. You guys ready? All right, so let's try this. Danielle, can we get, like, some big organ music, like, big, all right. That's good. So to start, you have the Reformed Protestants and the Protestant Reform, not to be confused with one another. And the Reform group are fascinating because they didn't even like the word reformed. In fact, they felt like the word reformed kind of like was like we nailed it once and for all. Kind of like it was all messed up, but we reformed it and now it's fixed. But they didn't like that. So they came up with this word reforming. And thus, this began kind of the endless process of rediscovering and innovating the message of Jesus and moving it forward. And then came the Presbyterians and the Methodists, and they brought us like this whole school of acting when it came to church. And then the Methodist said, hey, like, what if somebody doesn't know or has never heard about Jesus? Like, where do they start? And so they formed all these methods, AKA their name, the Methodists. And then you have the Lutherans, and they came along, and there's a guy by the name of Martin Luther who they liked a lot. His microphone was turned up just a bit louder than everybody else's. And he came along and said, whoa, I think we've missed a few things along the way. For instance, you don't earn your salvation. You can't buy your salvation. It's something God gives us. And so he said, you know, I think there's some central things we've got to get back to. And then, of course, the Episcopalians came, and they taught us how to pronounce these really long words, and thus the movement of God continued forward.
This is my story. This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long.
Next came the evangelicals, and they were like, whoa, wait a second, evangelius, that means good news, that means gospel, like that's the good news, and the good news isn't just for like this small country club group of people, it's good news for everybody, it's like an all skate, like this is my story, this is my song, this is what God's done in me, everybody needs to experience this, so they begin to share it. And then the Baptists came along, and they're just like, man, just dunk them, and everything's going to be good, and so that's what they did. And then they're like, but there's more to it than that. There's these defining spiritual moments. In fact, we need to introduce people to this life-changing message of Jesus that gets in and it begins to change us. And it tweaks us, not from the outside in, but from the inside out. And then, of course, there were covenants and Pentecostals and the Assemblies of God. And the Assemblies of God, they were basically like, hey, does that go any louder? So the Pentecostals are like, man, we love the spontaneous move of the Spirit. We love this spontaneous groove that we find, but we've kind of missed this Spirit of God moving among us. And yeah, there's thoughtfulness, we got to use our brains, but what about this intangible, mysterious quality of God? And so they're like, hey, miracles? Watch. Boom. And all of a sudden, they'd see the move of God's Spirit. And then you had the apostolics, and you had the missionary church, and you had the missionary alliance, the Anglican church, you had the disciples of Christ, and the church of Christ, both instrumental and non-instrumental. And then you had the independents, and the non-denominational, and the undenominational, very important distinctions not to be confused with one another. And then out of that, you had the Wesleyan church, which happens to just have its headquarters just up the road from us right here. And then out of the Wesleyan church began this thing called the Church of God movement, which wasn't a denomination. There's no creeds or no codes. It was rather identified as a movement because the idea was that people on the outside looking in would see the movement of God within this group of people and the change that was happening in the world so much so that they wanted to be a part of it. And thus, out of this movement was birthed Crosspoint. Fun. Was that not fun? How about Crosspoint Band and Brad leading us through that? Man, lots of fun. You know, we can kind of poke fun at our history, but the reality is, I mean, there's so many different versions and brands of Protestant faith. And the musical genres kind of help us understand it, but you know, let's be honest, the rules have a way of doing this as well. And so, you know, if you grew up Baptist, I mean, every denomination had its rules, Baptists had their rules, and if you grew up Presbyterian, they had their set of rules. Now, if you're a Methodist, we felt like the Methodists needed a few more rules, like they had way too much fun, like they needed a few more because they didn't seem to have very many. And then, of course, the Catholics, they kind of had their thing. And so the question I want us to explore this weekend is, what's with all the rules? Like, why the rules? And why is this so a part of religion? And let's be honest, you don't have to raise your hand on this, but like, this is what we resist, right? This is what we rebel against. And isn't that part of why, like, many of us left the faith of our childhood and whatever tradition that may have been, whether it was the temple or the mosque or, you know, the Catholic parish or some Protestant, you know, faith of some kind, because the rules were so burdensome and they didn't seem to, like, intersect and work with the real world. And so what I want us to look at today is the relationship between rules and religion. And maybe even explore if there is a relationship. And I want us to kind of go back to the starting point of rules when it comes to religion. So I want us to begin with this premise, because you may not have even thought of this before. But see, rules always assume that there's a relationship. All right, so whenever you have rules, there's an assumption that this is in the context of a relationship. And this isn't just in the religious sense. I mean, this is in the secular sense. We experience this all throughout our life. And so whenever you find yourself accountable to something, you realize I have a relationship with that entity. Now, to kind of help us understand this, get the conversation going a bit, I want to give us like some categories to understand this through. And these aren't all encompassing by any means, but I think they'll be helpful to kind of help us understand this. So you have, for instance, the family model of rules, and then you have the club model of rules. Now, the family model was like the family you were born into, right? Like you became a part of a family. And then after you were born into that family, your parents began to make rules for how the family was going to operate. But they didn't make the rules to establish whether you were going to be in the family or not. But you're already in the family, and so they were establishing rules. So like when you were a kid, you had rules that your parents gave you, right? And then you're like a junior high, and you had more rules when you're in junior high. You got to high school, and you're like, oh my gosh, there's so many rules that my parents are giving me. And then you eventually outgrew the family. You went into adulthood, and you outgrew the rules of that family, where they didn't apply to you anymore. But when you were a kid, they applied, right? Because not because it was how you became a part of the family, but because you were part of the family, it established how you were going to operate as a family. And your parents set these rules for you. Now, here's the interesting thing about rules and parents setting rules, right? Parents only set rules for their own kids. You know what I'm saying? But let's be honest. We've all met kids. We'd like to set some rules for their outside of our family, right? Like how many of us have like would just love to put some restrictions on the neighbor kids next door? Like you're like, you know, as long as I'm here, like you can't come outside. Like you are inside indefinitely. Now, when we move, you're welcome to play outside all you want, right? But like we don't do that. And so, and you don't probably ever call your neighbor and say, hey, could I talk to your daughter? And then you get on the phone with her and you're like, how much screen time have you had today? And is your homework done? And why are you still up at this time of night? Like, you don't do that, or hopefully you don't do that, right? Why not? Because they're not your kids, right? You only do that with your kids. And this is so important to understand when it comes to rules. See, in a family sense of the word, rules are only for the members of the family, all right? They don't make you a part of the family, but they establish, once you're in the family, how you're going to operate together as a family. And the parental figures, I mean, whether that's mom or dad or grandma or grandpa, whoever the parental figure is, sets the rules. Now, the next model is the club model, all right? Now, the club model is where you agree to keep some rules, and those, you're agreeing to that establishes whether you get in or you get to enter into the relationship. And so, like, when you join a club, for instance, I mean, you sign a contract, right? And they kind of give you the rules, and if you agree, then you get in, right? And if you don't agree, if you break the rules, then you basically get kicked out, right? And so this could be the employee model as well. Like you interview for a job and this potential employer says, now here's kind of how we operate and here's our culture and here's what we expect of you and here's your job description and here's the contract, and you get the contract and you're evaluated based on that contract, and basically whether you follow the job description or not determines whether you stay or not. And this works for fraternities. It works for sororities. It works for fitness memberships. And as many of us learned, it worked for Columbia House in our earlier years, right? And so, like, you have an agreement that establishes the rules for how you operate. And so these are different, right? I mean, you have the family model, which the rules are there because of the relationship. And then you have the club model, which are there to establish the relationship. Now, just for fun, and not to be confused, I think this will, you know, kind of give us another perspective. There's a third model that I want us to look at, and this is the neighborhood association model. Right? And this is like the model where you just don't know where you stand, right? Like they let you buy the house, they let you move in, and they don't really even tell you what the rules are, and as long as you like abide by the covenants that you don't even know about, like everything's fine, right? But like the moment you get squirrely and you like maybe don't follow one of the covenants, you get like a nasty letter in the mail, right? And you don't even know why. I mean, they're just like, hey, take the above ground pool out of your front yard, right? Or like, take your Christmas lights down. It's July. Or like, quit riding snowmobiles. Or, you know, that trampoline in the back. I mean, whatever it is. Like, you didn't even know there were rules, but you begin to hear this. This is the neighborhood association model. And it's kind of like you're in, but you're also kind of out because you don't really know. And they can't make you move. I mean, it's not like they can kick you out of your neighborhood, but they can make you wish that you didn't live in your neighborhood, right? Like, they can kind of like make life miserable. And so these are the three models, you know, that we have when it comes to rules. Now, here's the point. Wherever there are rules, it's because you are in a relationship, right? The two go together. But think about this. When you take these crazy kind of ideas right here and you transfer those into a religious system, it's no wonder it's so confusing, right? You're like, which one do I follow? Like, am I in? Am I out? I mean, am I in with God because I was like accepted into the family and there's nothing I can do to get out of the family, and so the rules are just there to kind of help me know how to operate? Or is it like, as long as you behave, like sign on the line, as long as you behave the right way, you're in, but if you don't, you're out? Or is it like, I don't know. I mean, I'm a human being, so I'm in and nobody can like kick me out, but then you get a note in your mailbox, you know, and like everybody's mad at you and the Facebook page is shaming you in the neighborhood, and you know, before long, you're like, you know, they're like, we're not happy with you, but we can't kick you out, so we're going to let you live here as long as you're on the planet, but we hope you don't stay too long. And so the interesting thing is we look at these rules, and you begin to think through these different models, you know, these different categories. Some of us begin to think theologically, right? And then others of us begin to think, like, emotionally, because there's so much emotion tied to each of our experiences in these. And see, some of you, when it comes to spirituality, you were taught the family model, but you always felt like you were in the club model. And then some of you, you were taught the club model, but you've never really felt like you were part of a family. So it's like, which one is it? And how do I know? And see, here's the thing. Regardless of what faith tradition you choose to pursue, I mean, of all the traditions, at some point along the way, you're going to have to figure this out. Like, at some point along the way, you're going to have to figure out, how does my behavior line up with God? And what does God expect of me? And how do I know I'm in? And how do I know I'm out? And, like, how the heck do I even know what I'm supposed to do? So, to kind of help us wrestle with this, I want to go all the way back to one of the oldest sets of laws that are ever given. Now, they're not the oldest, but it's one of the most, the oldest documented sets of laws. And this is also, this is, you know, reported in both Jewish literature and Christian literature, as well as Islamic literature. So, I mean, the major three faith traditions all report, like, this moment. This is history right here. These are the most well-known. They're called the Ten Commandments. So back in 1446 BC, the Ten Commandments show up on planet Earth, and God basically gives these to Moses. At least that's what Christians believe. That's even what the Jewish tradition believes. It's what the Nation of Islam believe. All right, you can figure that out for yourself. It's why we're talking about this. Now, here's what's interesting about the Ten Commandments. Maybe you've noticed this. Like, nobody knows all 10 of them, right? Like, I mean, think to yourself. You're like, oh, I know them all. Well, just think, like, which ones do you know? Just, like, think out loud for a moment. Like, what do you know? You're like, oh, well, do not commit adultery. I know that's one of them, right? And I think there's one about, like, I shouldn't steal, and don't they say something about, like, telling the truth or something like that? But that's, like, the extent of what you usually know when it comes to the rules, right? And the other thing that's interesting about the Ten Commandments is that nobody knows where they're at. Have you ever noticed that? Like, you're like, well, I know they're in here. Like, you open your Bible, and you're like, I know they're in here somewhere. And you just start flipping through, and you're like, well, surely the table of contents, like, if they're that important, they're going to be in the table of contents. You go to the table of contents, and it's not there. So you're like, well, this is the Bible. I mean, surely they're in here. So I'm going to tell you where they are, just so you know, all right? This is like a gift, all right? So just say this out loud with me, all right? Say Exodus 20. There you go, all right? So where are the Ten Commandments found? Man, now that was probably worth just showing up tonight, right? I mean, that was worth like putting your pants on and like sitting in front of the TV today. I mean, that was like worth the price of admission to know that the Ten Commandments are where? See, now you know. All right, now, before we dig into them, all right, before we dig into them, I want to kind of tie kind of all this together so far. And if you weren't here last week, I'll bring you a little bit up to speed. So last week we looked at a guy by the name of Abraham. And Abraham, again, according to the big three faith traditions, all agree that this is kind of where faith begins. God begins kind of the faith starting point with Abraham. And so Abraham was promised by God. God said, hey, I'm going to make you a great nation, a great nation. Now, the problem for Abraham was that he didn't have any children. He's going, how can I be a nation if I can't even have a family? And the other problem was that he was old. And so Sarah, his wife, looks at him. She's like, you know, Abraham, we're getting up there. I mean, we're old, and I haven't been able to have any children, but my handmaiden can. So why don't you and her go and, like, just, you know, why don't you go and, like, you know? And so they did. And out of that came a child who was named Ishmael. All right, so Ishmael is a son of Abraham. And then later on, as it turns out, Sarah actually gets pregnant with Abraham, and she has a son named Isaac. So Abraham actually has two sons. Now, here's an interesting piece of information, a little history. All right, you can check this out on your own. But Ishmael, according to the faith tradition of Islam, Ishmael is considered the son of blessing. All right, whereas in Judaism and Christianity, Isaac is considered the son of blessing. So this is the point where the three big faith traditions begin to split off in two different directions, as you can see right here. Now, most of what we know about Islam, you know, in terms of believing that Ishmael is the son of blessing, was actually taught about 600 and some years after Jesus was on the scene. And so this is where the prophet Muhammad comes on the scene, and he begins to weave together this narrative that connects Ishmael to the Arab nations, and they claim him as kind of the blessed son. All right, and so there you go. You got like a little religious history right there. Now, Isaac had a son. All right, his other son, Isaac, had a son named Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, which is also kind of called the 12 tribes of Israel. Again, a little history lesson right there. And one of these sons had a son whose name was Joseph. And you've heard of Joseph before because he had a technicolor dream coat. All right, so maybe you saw a show. Yeah. Love that. So Joseph, his brothers didn't like the fact that he had this really colorful coat. So they put him in a pit and basically left him to die. And he ends up in Egypt for the rest of his life, kind of isolated. And years later, he kind of works his way up. And get this, he becomes the prime minister of the nation of Egypt. And it just happens to be in a time when the whole world or the whole region is in the midst of a famine. And so Joseph, he has this idea. He sends an email to his sons and his brothers and, you know, his family. And he's like, hey, I don't know if you guys have food because the famine's going on, but we've got plenty of food here in Egypt. And so all of his children and grandchildren and relatives make their way to Egypt. And so he's got all his family there, and they're like rabbits. They're like reproducing like you can't believe. I mean, they just keep multiplying and multiplying and multiplying, so much so that some of the people in Egypt go to Pharaoh, and they're like, Pharaoh, I don't know if you're noticing this or not, but like these Israelites, these 12 tribes, I mean, they just keep multiplying and multiplying. Before long, they're going to outnumber the Egyptians in our homeland right here in Egypt. And so Pharaoh, he enslaves the Israelites. And so get this, for 400 years, this nation is a slave nation. They know nothing but slavery, generation after generation after generation. In fact, they get together as families, and they tell stories about Father Abraham. And the parents would be like, kids, you know, Father Abraham, I mean, God gave him a promise that he was going to be a great nation. And these kids would all be sitting around, and he'd have a little one in the back raise his hand. He's like, yeah, you in the back. He's like, are we that nation? He's like, yes, we're that nation. And the kid would be like, but we're slaves. And the parent would go, well, I mean, it didn't quite work out the way that we thought it was going to work out. But God has promises. God had promised Father Abraham that he's going to bless the whole world through us. Yeah, but we're slaves. I mean, yeah, I mean, I know it didn't work out that way, but it's just one of those moments where what we were told to believe doesn't really match kind of the realities of our lives. Which is really interesting, because even way back then, they were feeling that. Maybe you've felt that. And so once again, there's a conflict between what we're told to believe and what we actually experience. And so for 400 years, they tell these mythical stories. For 400 years, they talk about Abraham, and God gave him a dream, and he had a son, and that guy had a son, and Joseph, he had a dream, and God's going to do something, but it's been so long. And they're like, are these people just feeding us these stories to like instill hope in us? Because we don't see anything. We don't see the mountain moving. I mean, we don't see evidence of God doing anything. And then one day, just totally out of the blue, a guy by the name of Moses shows up. And he goes to Pharaoh, and you probably know this line, and he says, "Let my people, the Israelites, go." And Pharaoh looks at him, and he's like, "Absolutely not. I'm not going to let your people go." And so Moses says, "Okay, just watch this." And all of a sudden, like, nature completely freaks out. I mean, completely freaks out. I mean, there's like locusts and boils and ticks and frogs and water pollution. I mean, it goes on and on. And all these things, these calamities, like, hit the nation of Egypt. And it just destroys the Egyptian economy. And finally, Pharaoh was so fed up with just all these things that keep happening, that keep tearing the spirit and his community and his economy down. He looks at Moses. He's like, "Fine, get out of here. Take all your stuff and your people and just get out of here." And so Moses leads the nation of Israel, the Hebrews, out of Egypt. Right, and the cool thing is all three big faith traditions, all three of them, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, all agree. This is history right here. Now, about 3 weeks later, they end up, as they're walking out of Egypt, at the base of Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai is the place where Moses, Charlton Heston, if you've watched the movie, goes to get the Ten Commandments. Now, this is so important right here because, see, all they've known is slavery. All they've known is how to be slaves. They don't even know their God. They didn't even know they had a God, all right? They're just slaves, and for generations, they've never known freedom. And so they go to Mount Sinai, and Moses goes up on the mountain, and God gives this nation their first set of laws. And part of this is what we know of as the Ten Commandments, which are found in... Man, you guys are paying attention. Look at you. All right, so I want to read the prelude to them receiving the Ten Commandments. Right? I want to read kind of the precursor, the introduction right here. This is so amazing because it gives us insight to the relationship between God and the laws that he's giving them and how it fits together. So take a look at this. Exodus chapter 20, verse 1. "And God spoke all these words, and he said, 'I am the Lord your God.'" And they're like, "Really?" He's like, "Yep, I'm the Lord your God." Like, "Well, if you're our Lord, then that makes us your people, right?" He's like, "Yep, that's it." And they're like, "Okay, well, how did that happen?" Like, I mean, we were like for 400 years slaves in Egypt, and then all of a sudden somebody brings us out here and dumps us in the middle of the desert. Like, how did this happen? I mean, all of a sudden, like, we haven't done anything, and yet all of a sudden we've got a God, and we're your people. Like, how does that happen? He goes on, he says, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." Now, this is huge right here. What he's basically saying is, "I'm the Lord your God who has done something for you, even though you've done nothing for me." Meaning, in your darkest moment, and when you felt like there was no hope, and when that story of Father Abraham, and you'd sit around the fire and be like, "Father Abraham," it just seemed like some fairy tale story, because nothing seemed to be coming to fruition. I mean, when nobody expected it, "I sent a deliverer to Egypt, and I delivered you out of Egypt. I'm the Lord your God." There's this miraculous, spectacular moment where I did something for you, even though you didn't deserve it. And they're looking around, they're going, "You're right. We didn't deserve it, and we didn't even know we had a God. And gosh, if we have a God, that means there's rules. We don't even know what the rules are. I mean, are we following the rules? Have we broken the rules? We didn't even know what they were." And it's as if God says, I know. But before I give you the rules, let's just establish something. You're mine, and I'm yours. And so let's just establish that before we go about setting any rules. And something really interesting happens next in Egypt. You can go back and look at the plagues, and you can read about, you know, the Exodus and how that all happened and all that. But the Egyptian economy is decimated. And so Pharaoh begins to have second thoughts of whether he's going to let Moses and his people go. And so God, through Moses, he actually speaks to this Jewish nation. And he says, "Hey, there's one thing I want you to do." All right, and again, there's no Ten Commandments. There's no laws yet. There's just something that God wants him to do. And so Moses says, on behalf of God, "We're still in Egypt. And so God wants you to trust him." God's saying, "Would you just trust me?" And so what he tells them, he says, "Tonight, before you go to bed, I want you to slaughter a lamb. I want you to slaughter a sheep," which they've done, you know, many times before. He says, "And I want you to eat a meal," which again, they've done many times before. He says, "But this time, when you slaughter that lamb, I want you to take the blood of that lamb, and I want you to paint it all around the doorpost of your front door of your home and up and down the sides of the door." And they're like, "Yeah, but why would we do that?" He's like, "Would you just trust me?" Yeah, but I mean, it's not going to make any difference. Why? This doesn't make any sense to me. And God looks at them and he's like, would you just trust me? So that night, a majority of the nation of Israel, this Jewish nation, they eat a special meal and they slaughter a sheep. And most of them took the blood and they painted it around their door frame. And then later that evening, they packed their bags and all of their belongings because they'd be leaving. And people were, of course, like, what do you mean we're leaving? Why we got to pack everything up? And we've been here for 400 years. Why is it so important? We got to leave, like, right now. And it's like, God's like, would you just trust me? And that night, the angel of death went all throughout Egypt. And it passed over every household that had the blood of the lamb painted around the doorframe. And the next morning, Pharaoh woke up, whom did not have the blood of the lamb painted across his doorframe. And his son was deceased. And he was in despair. And in his despair, he said, Moses, get out of here. Leave. Take everything you own. Take everything that we own that you have and just get out. And from that moment on, the Jewish nation of Israel would celebrate the festival, the Passover, not because of the Ten Commandments. They didn't even have the Ten Commandments yet. But they'd celebrate the festival, the Passover, to remember that that was the night where God whispered to them, I just want you to trust me. And in trusting me, I'm going to deliver you from slavery, and I'm going to take you out of Egypt. And so 3 weeks later, they find themselves at the foot of Mount Sinai. And God says, all right, I'm going to give you some law. I'm going to give you some guiding principles. But before we do that, let's just not forget the main thing. I'm the Lord your God. You are my people. All right, I'm the one who delivered you out of slavery when you didn't deserve to be delivered out of slavery. And now that we have that established, we know that I'm yours and you're mine. Now, here's some ways that we can learn to live together. Here's some things that will help you understand what it means to live in community. Here's what it means to live under my authority. And so he gives him the first commandment, which is absolutely amazing. Because when he gives him the first commandment, you know, we think, oh, it's like, thou shalt not fill in the blank, right? That wasn't the first commandment that he gave them. In fact, take a look at what he gave them. The first one was, you shall have no other gods before me. The nation of Israel collectively like laughs. Seriously? Let me get this straight. So, like, you deliver us from slavery. We didn't have a land, and now you gave us a land. We didn't have a God, and now we have a God. We didn't have a freedom, now we have a freedom. Now our kids have freedom, our grandchildren have freedom. All right? We have a leader, and all you want to do is make sure that we don't have any other gods before you? Like, that's it? And God's like, yep. Like, I mean, listen, you completely annihilated the Egyptian nation, but you decimated their economy. You embarrassed Pharaoh. You just want to know if you can be our God and we'll be your people and nothing else will be between you and us? Absolutely. Boom. Done. What else do you have for us, God? See, here's the point. The Ten Commandments were a confirmation of, not a condition of, the relationship between God and his people. All right, it wasn't a condition of, it wasn't like, well, here the 10 are, and as long as you follow these, you're going to be my people. Or if you just follow 5 of the 10, I think we'll still make it okay. But if you violate like 8, I might have to find a new people. All right, it wasn't that at all. I mean, he could have done that. Probably should have done this. This is so important. This is 1,500 years before Jesus. This is 2,100 years before the prophet Muhammad came on the scene. See, this is as far back as we can go, and we can connect the law and the rules, the starting point of them, to God. And it didn't have to be this way. It could have been totally conditional, but he didn't do it that way. I mean, as far back as we can go, God made it really clear. Listen, let's get first things first. You're my people. I'm your God, even though you haven't done anything to deserve it. And now that we've established that relationship, I just want to teach you how to live together and how to live under my authority. And so let's begin with the basics. Just don't have any other gods before me. And then from there, we'll begin to show you that I can continue to demonstrate that you can trust me. And this is where we're going to leave it. And we'll pick up next week. Now, I want to give you a question And this is your homework. And so if you're in a small group, your small group's going to talk about this question. And if you're not in a small group, you can talk about this question on the way home. You can talk about this question over dinner, over coffee this week, with a friend, with a spouse, whoever it might be. But I want you to talk about this question. So here's the question. Growing up, now I don't want you to get all theological on this, all right? Because sometimes you're like, oh, I know what the right answer is. It looks like a squirrel, but it's really Jesus, right? Like, don't go theological. I want you to talk feeling on this question, emotion on this question. Growing up, did you feel like religion was based on the family model or the club model or the neighborhood association model? All right, as you think about what it felt like growing up, how were you raised? How were you taught? How'd you feel? When you laid at bed at night and you laid there in the dark and you said your prayer to God, like, which model did you approach God out of? Right, when you'd go to church, you'd sit in Sunday school if you went to church, or if you didn't go to church and you wondered, okay, what are they teaching at church that I'm missing? Like, which model did you assume was kind of the way God worked? You know, when you ask the question, how good do I have to be for God to love me? Which model was the one you applied? I mean, did you feel like God had adopted you into a family? And once you're in, I mean, once you're adopted, like, there's nothing you can do to ever be kicked out. And the rules aren't there to evaluate if you should be in or not. They're more there just to establish, like, how we operate and live together. Or was it a little more like the club model, where it's like, hey, if you keep your end of the deal and you do the right things and you behave the right way, don't embarrass us too bad, then we're going to keep you. But if not, you're out. Like, we're kicking you out. Or was it like, I don't know. Like, I never knew. It was like HOA, right? Like, I'm here. Apparently there's rules. I don't know what they are. Nobody really tells me, but people get mad at me and I get nasty emails and people are trying to make me feel bad and they shame me and so on and so forth. I want you to wrestle this question to the ground, because in doing so, again, you'll take another step in understanding either your current faith or what it means to have a starting point in faith. And then we'll pick it up here next week and we'll continue this journey. Any questions? All right, good. All right, go ahead and stand. Let me pray for us, and we're going to sing one more song. God, thank you. Man, thank you for, first of all, preserving this ancient teaching right here. Through thousands of years, that you give us a glimpse of who you are and how you relate to your people. And God, I just pray that you'd open our eyes to whatever we might need to see right now. And regardless of what we've experienced growing up, regardless of what we may have believed about you in the past or been told about you or felt, and God, for those of us who are listening or watching online, who maybe years ago just gave up, and we gave up the hope that we could ever know you, that we could ever be known by you, that we could ever be loved by you, God, I just pray that your grace and mercy would just shine a little bit of hope into our lives right now. As we sing this song, would you remind me, would you remind us, would you remind us collectively that we are yours?